Hey, buddy.
What's going on, Marcus? How you doing, sir?
How you doing, man?
Doing good, man. What's up, brother?
Not much, bro. What area are you in?
Louisville, Kentucky.
Kentucky? All right.
Yeah. So, Marcus, looking back at everything you've been through in life, do you ever doubt yourself or second guess if you're going to be able to make it through what you've been through in life? Because if people follow you, know who you are, and have watched your wrestling career and the stuff afterwards, they some of us know what you've been through, you know? Have you ever had a guess if you're going to make through it or not?
That's a great question, brother. And I got to think about that for a minute. In life, second guess was never a thing. Leading up to sports, I wanted to box at a young age. I won the Golden Glove State Championship of Georgia. I wanted to play football and wasn't the best on the team, but was probably one of the best, quarterback, great athlete. Baseball, same thing, all county, all state. But going into it, it was, going to be the best, try to be the best at it, the best possible that you could be. And not trying to be like the best on the team, but take it back, shooting to be the best on the team, shooting to be the best at everything. But the sobriety thing, brother, was different. You go into it thinking, when I went to rehab, it ain't like I wasn't trying to get sober. So, my first rehab I went to was 5 days. And they literally was the first rehab I went to. And it was, early 2000, right after WCW. It was in Dalton, Georgia. And I remember back then they called a full detox 5 days. And when you go to rehab is still a 5-day detox. And this time they were saying that if you detox, you're clean, so you can get sober now. And that could not be further from the truth. I did the first rehab, I did 5 days and thought I'd be okay. And then looking back on it, it was never a time that I wasn't not putting the work in. Looking at my medical record of what was wrong with me, and what was wrong with me was I had severe sleep apnea, but I had not been diagnosed with it. So from a young age, really diving into my addiction at a very young age, I was fighting this thing called sleep apnea, but there wasn't even a word. So I'm trying to fight something that's not even been a word yet. And that is in 1982, we'll back up. When I got the diagnosis in 1995, I was 25 years old, that what I had, it started putting so many pieces together. I was like, wait a minute, and that's why. I backtracked it to 12 years old. At 12 years old, my father woke me up and he goes, "You're choking in your sleep." Well, now that I put all the pieces together, from me choking in my sleep led to me being sleepy during football practice, leading to me doing cocaine that my father gave me under my wristband to play football and giving me a hit of speed also. Again, that was out of love for my father. He loved his son, saw me suffering, but his answer was to give me cocaine to help me get energy to go play ball. I didn't do it with baseball and I didn't do it to go to school. We looked at it like, okay, I'm tired before ball games, so I'm going to do this little bit of cocaine and then go play football. And I'd go out and throw 2 touchdown passes and run 3 touchdowns. And when it was over, I didn't want more cocaine. I thought I was taking medication for something that we didn't know what it was. Fighting a ghost. And then when you look back on it, that was a bad habit to get into. I learned to fix what was wrong with me. And by fixing it was later on in life, still not being diagnosed yet with sleep apnea, I would take Lortabs and Somas because it made me feel better when I was tired. And then it led to when I had atrial fibrillation, I remember going to my parents and going, "I need some Somas." They're like, "Mark, man, you already took like 10 Somas today." I go, "I know, but it's my heart." And they didn't believe me. I could see it in their eyes. I go, "Guys, I swear to you, I'm not lying. 5 years of taking a bunch of Somas every day. And then I get diagnosed with atrial fibrillation, which means your heart don't beat even. Your heart is a muscle and Somas are muscle relaxers." Gotcha. So again, looking back on it and diagnosing is really easy. when you're in it and you don't know, and you're just trying to throw anything at it you can because you don't feel normal, it created a hell of a drug addict. And when it was, and by the end of it was, you know, they put a CPAP on me, cardio burnt my heart. They can't fix swallowing 60 pills a day with a case of beer. That takes some rehab and some mental stuff. And so, you know, long story short, I finally got there, but it took me 20 years, you know, 20 years I was heavily sedated for 20 years.
Yeah, I could only imagine. Now, I watched your Dark Side of the Ring last night. So before we get into your episode, far more often than not, a lot of people say a lot of it isn't true, or it's like make-believe and stuff like that. Now, getting into your episode, how much of that was reality versus fiction?
I was so happy when that thing was over, man. It's a crazy, really good story, and I tell it well, but it don't mean they got to tell it well. When I was over, I was ecstatic, happy with how it went, how it was talked about. Everything in there I felt like was done fantastic. So 100% spot on. Of course, the dude, the bald-headed guy, Slick, you know, he put a little jelly on everything, but I mean, but very little. I mean, like, my mom didn't actually hold my privates to shave, but she was shaving me right there with them all looking, me being naked, but you know, he put a little extra jelly on there, you know, but that, besides that though, it was all 100% true. And all of it happened just the way it did. And I thought they did a great job telling the story. The one thing I saw in the very beginning, even when it was getting filmed, was I knew in the end of this, it was going to carry a lot of weight. Two ex-wives spoke highly about me. These are two ex-wives.
That's rare.
Brother, very rare. It's two ex-wives that I divorced. I divorced both of them. And to get those two women to talk good about men, that just don't happen, brother. So right. I knew that was going to be a big part of my story on people going, we may be missing something on this guy here. Man, he's got two women still talking good about him that he divorced. Overall, I was ecstatic with it all. So let's talk about any part of it. It was a really accurate, very satisfying episode to me.
Now, I want to specifically talk on that situation with your father in the kitchen. So, like, I'm a man that still at 39 years old suffers from a lack of relationship with his own father. I still find myself at like a little boy wanting to have his dad or daddy, however you want to word it. So that kind of brought me back to moments. So I was like, oh shit. So I can relate to a degree, you know. How hard was that for you reliving that mentally when you've seen that in the episode?
Absolutely not hard at all. What happened that day, brother, was something that the day it happened, I was fine with. I had no problems with what I did. I was okay with my brothers now, and they're tough. My brothers are tough, but they were a little skittish around me. They were like, you know, we'd be eating and they'd be like keeping their eye on me while we were eating. And I'm like, what's wrong with y'all, man? They're like, oh, we're good. You know, like, you know, looking at me like I was going to snap and shoot them or something. I go, guys, you know how dad is, man. Don't act like this is crazy. Because something that didn't make Dark Side was just about 6 months before that, my father shot at my brother in the floor. They were having words over something. And so now that you saw the whole Dark Side, think about me seeing my big brother, my idol, get shot at by his father in the floor over an argument. And I was like, I mean, I cried about it. I was, you know, 17 years old. I cried. Six months later, that same father is beating up my mama and pulls a gun on me. And I'm like, wait a minute, bro, hold on, you know? And it got out of hand pretty quick. But when I pulled the gun up to shoot him, it was about, to me, it was a couple of minutes long. Like, I went up and I said, shoot the windshield out. Make a scene. Let's make a scene here by shooting the windshield out. Clear as day in my head. Boom. And I said, shoot the windshield out. The third shot, I said, kill him. Don't know where it came from, but I went, kill him. I put it on him. Boom, boom, boom. 6 months later, the first time me and my father talked about it, he thought I had my 45 automatic because I squeezed him so fast. Boom, 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 just like that. Five times he said, I thought you had your 45 automatic because it was so fast. But to my brain, I swear to God, it was at least a minute long. Like, just do the windshield. Okay, get your aim ready. Windshield. All right, kill him. Boom. But he said it was as fast as could be. So in that process, from the time of doing that, I was tried to kill him. I was mad at him. He was beating up my mom. He beat up my mom several times, but that it got to be, he got, it started getting out of hand. So that day, what happened is they were arguing. When I went down and I pulled him off of her, I overpowered him. And as soon as I did, our eyes met and he bolted for the refrigerator. And I was like, oh my God. So the gun came out, you know, and then the cable guy was there too, and blah, blah. So when he came out and did all that, it embarrassed me when he shot the wheels out of the car and he drug my mom out the window. And when I saw the cable guy see it, and it embarrassed me so bad, I did some kind of, I'm sure it's got to be a word, but I blacked out, a non-medicine, non-alcohol blackout. Didn't know what a blackout even was, except I went into one because I went away and I ran and got a gun.
Right.
And I passed the refrigerator where the gun always sat. That's where Dad got the gun from. I went to his office and got a gun. I passed the refrigerator, got that gun. So when I came back, I was back in, did the shooting. Even at home, I moved out. I went to my brother's house, moved in with him. Dad's in the hospital, and mom for about a week. That seemed like a week, probably a couple of days. A couple of days, she was like, "You need to call your daddy. You need to call." I said, "Mom, I'm never talking to him again." She goes, "Son, you need to." So for 2 days, your mom's asking you to do something. So finally, about that third or fourth day, I call him and I'm like, "Hey man, what's going on?" He goes, "What do you think's going on? I'm in the effing hospital." I said, look, man, I didn't call to click. And I was like, "I'm done. That's fine with me." I called mom up. I said, "Hey, I tried.
You did your part. Yeah.
I did my part. I didn't want to call in the first place. I'm done." So he, about 2 weeks later, got out of the hospital. He called me up and said, "I want you to know I'm sorry. And you're totally in the right. You did exactly what I raised you to do. You protected your mother, and I'm sorry. You can come back home anytime you want." And I came back home, and it was super weird, bro. I mean, you shoot your old man.
Right.
You know, it just, nowadays, it's nothing because it was, you know, 30 plus years ago. But at the time, brother, it was weird, man. I mean, like one time I tossed him a remote, and when he caught it, he was like, oh, my arm. I'm like, come on, man. You know, like I shot him in the arm. He says, and it could be true, he says he went like this and it blocked it from going in his heart. That's what his story is. But I thought it was on the door and that shot is what I thought. But regardless, a pistol from 50 yards, it's hard to hit a wall, brother. Pistols are really tough to hit an arm, you know, 50 yards away. And for sure. Boom, 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 boom. You know, fast squeezes. I can't believe I didn't hit the car once, and I was shooting for the windshield. Didn't hit the car, and I hit him. So to me, everything happens for a reason, and that was meant to be.
That's something that it's hard to come back from. So it's crazy that you guys can still honestly have a relationship after that. But I think almost equally to me, because when I watched it last night after I got home, because your father said in it when he was getting interviewed during it, he admitted in the right, kind of like what you just said. I was like, my gosh, who admits that they were wrong for getting, you know what I'm saying? Like
that, getting shot. Yeah. No, it was crazy, bro. And it had been happening for a while. And like I said, to even say it back and to not add alcohol or drugs involved, there was zero alcohol involved, zero drugs involved. It was just a man that was going broke that was snapping, and he was just in a horrible mood and mad, and they kept fighting because he blamed my mom, of course, for going broke, and that all that was going on. And hell, I'm playing ball, man. I'm still in school, you know, so I'm having to deal with all this. And
if I could say, you were 17 at the time, right?
Yeah, I was an old 17, but you know, probably, you know, junior or beginning of a senior year, and just, you know, just trying to do high school stuff, playing ball and, you know, going to school and girls and stuff. So, you know, it was a big deal for me, of course. And my brothers thought, like I said, they were a little bit weirded out about it. They were, you know, and again, my oldest brother just had got shot at by him, but they still were like, "You shot Dad?" And I go, "Yes." And he was beating up mother, bro. And they were like, "Okay, man, whatever."
What's your relationships been like with your brothers? Because I know as a man that has a brother, value that relationship and friendship with my brother. What's it like for you with your brothers?
We watched my father and his brothers not communicate and not get along good at all. We loved our uncles. Our uncles were legends in the town we grew up in. We were the Bagwells, man. And not just my Bagwells, my dad Bagwells were infamous, man. They had the fastest cars, and their father had the first lawnmower and the first nice car. car and the furnace in their house and the first air conditioning unit and the first color television. So they were the Bagwells of Marietta. And every time you come to Marietta, they were the toughest and they had the fastest cars. And that's the only two things there was in the 60s, brother. That was it. The 50s and 60s was about race cars and fighting. And that's what my dad and his brothers were good at both. My father is in the NHRA Hall of Fame. He's in the National Hot Rod Association Hall of Fame. So he's incredibly great at drag racing. So from a young age, they had the best cars. They were good looking people, good looking boys, and they were tough. So anybody that knew came to town was like, where the Bagwells at? With that, we fell in love with our uncles because they were tough and they were good athletes and all of that. So, but my dad and his brothers didn't get along good. And me and my brothers always said, we were never going to do that. We were never going to be apart from each other. And damn if we ain't drifted apart, me and my middle brother, which we couldn't get along for 2 seconds growing up. We're super close. And me and my oldest brother, well, me and my middle brother don't talk to my oldest brother. Actually, I got to say, he don't talk to us. And I don't know. And we don't know why. I tried him at Thanksgiving and got no reply. I tried him on his birthday. And his birthday is the day after mine. We're January 10th and January 11th. And so we had our birthday together on the same day for 30 years. And so I call him on his birthday, no reply for Thanksgiving and no reply for this birthday. No happy birthday to me. So the first time in 54 years, which is my whole life, that I didn't talk to my oldest brother. And so I called my brother John and go, dude, what is going on? He goes, I don't know, man. I can't figure it out. So he don't know why either. And so he just kind of, you know, struck us out of his life. So I hate that. And we said we are never going to do that, but we're in the same position. Just what happens to everybody is life happens, man. And we've drifted apart.
Definitely, definitely. So I want to touch base on your wrestling career. Sorry. Thank you. Have a success that you did.
Say that again.
Did you ever think you would have the success that you did? And the second part of that, got success fairly quickly.
Yes. You know, nobody's ever talked about this quickly. But first of all, no, I go into everything, like I told you, at a young age. I mean, I wanted to box. I became a world champion, state champion. I wanted to, you know, play football. I became one of the best football. I wanted to get into shape. I became one of the best bodies. I mean, I didn't take losing well. I set goals and I reached them, you know?
Right.
And so this was a goal that I set out to do, but man, it was the toughest one I ever reached. I mean, I had a very young wrestling career. You know, it was hell. The first time I went, I came home and I said, I'm never going back. And I was the kid that could do everything. And my wife was like, you're not going back. What do you mean? I go, I'm telling you, this is the hardest thing I've ever done in my life. And the bad thing that was going for me, the bad part about knowing Missy was I knew the WCW schedule. So I went to go train and then saw how many times they work. And I went, you can't do what I just did that many times a month. There's no way to do it. And so I quit the very first time I went. I ain't going back. And some reason, I don't even know how or why, something made me go back and I kept going back. But about the third training time, the guy that was training me, Steve Lawler, said, look, brother, you really caught on quick and you got this. If you want to do it, you can, let me show you how it really works. And he lightened up on me and showed me some stuff. And I went, you've been beating me up for 3 days. And he goes, yeah, I have. And I go, God, I was mad, you know, but once I learned what it was like, we went to Global and I walked into the dressing room and the baby faces and heels were able to talk. And I went, wait a second, y'all can talk before going out there? And they go, yeah, what do you mean? And I go, I'm able to do this. The difference from Fabian at North Georgia Wrestling and my very first Handsome Stranger match, 50 times better, because I was able to talk to the guy a little bit and go out there. And just to communicate a little bit was really, I didn't realize how good I'd gotten by getting in the ring and two guys calling it from right here. I mean, with 12 people in the crowd, you can hear every pin drop. Calling a match green at lockup is almost impossible. But I gotten pretty good at trying to get it done. But from being able to take that to talk about it a little bit and then go out there, man, I went from being horrible pretty good overnight because of that. And then from there, man, it was just about fine tuning everything. And I was up and going. But used to answer your question, I used to always think it was like 5 or 6 years that it took me to make WCW. I really did. And when I look back on it, brother, you graduate and at 18 years old, I was on WCW TV in September of 91. So
6 months later,
I went to wrestling school. I mean, I went to massage therapy school for 10 months. I was a licensed massage therapist, brother. That's 10 months. And I worked at a company called Corporate Sports doing massage therapy. So that's a 10-month course. And I worked for Corporate Sport, let's just say, a couple of months. And then Missy sees me. That's a whole year. So, I mean, it couldn't have took more than a year and a half from me saying, I want to wrestle being on WCW TV. And that's so crazy. It's got nothing to do with me being good. That's got a lot to do with being at the right place at the right time, brother. And it ain't like Missy had a ton of stroke. She just had some stroke. And it ain't like she can get me a job, but she could also, she put it right in front of the right people. And the story is, there was a guy in charge of everything, above everything, kind of like God of wrestling, not WCW. Yep. Jim Barnett was his name. And I suppose he was supposed to be a homosexual man that loved Brian Pillman, and he loved the Z-Man. And it's been told, I never met the guy. It's been told to me that he loved me. That's just rumors and hate, a little bit of hate and maybe a little jealousy mixed in there. But Missy put it in front of the right people, man. You know, so I think a lot, you know, having the right hook, and also being able to wrestle those guys like Eddie Gilbert's and, you know, and just the Patriots and X-Pac at Global really got me like brushed up real quick. And I was ready for WCW, man.
Now, speaking of X-Pac, you guys were part of the NWO for several years. What was it like part of one of the greatest, if not the greatest, wrestling faction in the history of the sport? And then you and Sean, is that how you say it? Okay, I just want to make sure I said his name right.
Yeah,
had a lot of similar issues outside of the ring.
We did.
Does that make it special for you, the time you got to spend with him in the NWO?
It really, we never, you know, I've never partied with him one time. I kind of watched his addiction on TV like everybody did, and mine was kind of played out on the internet, kind of, you know. We never have talked about it. We never partied together. I just knew he had his demons and I had mine. But as NWO members, you know, we knew that we were, you know, young guys and we were, you know, we had a chance here. And he had a step on me for several reasons. One, he was a much better worker. Two, great friends with Scott and Kevin. Now, I was real good friends with Kevin, but Scott, I wasn't too good friends with Scott. We were buddies, but me and Kevin were very good friends. And Kevin's who got me in. He came to me and goes, do you want in the NWO? And I was like, are you kidding? Absolutely.
Duh.
So, yeah, please. And so, but Sean and me have always been super close, super nice. But he never lived in Georgia or anything, so we never really got to hang out much. It was just more of at work friends, you know.
Nothing wrong with that.
No.
So you brought up the addiction part again. I want to get back to that. I like to bounce around.
Sure.
And what moment in your wrestling career did you realize that the addiction and stuff like that, the issues that you were facing were actually bigger than you had thought they were?
Vividly, I did this. I was in Minneapolis, Minnesota, and it was probably, gosh, I'd say 90, right after I broke my neck. So 98, and I finally got a prescription in my name after my broke neck. We knew what a couple somas were. We knew how to take a couple of pain pills and have a beer. When you went to the club, that was it. I didn't have no prescriptions with my names on them. But after my broke neck, I did. Now I got my prescriptions and I got a reason that I can take pills. I broke my neck, brother. I'm injured. You know, that's the story I tell myself. I'm okay doing this. I'm allowed because I'm hurt. After that, I remember being in the car one day with Lex and having a beer or taking a pill until after Nitro was unheard of. So we would always, you know, get up, work out, tan, shave, all the stuff packed, everybody ready, go to the building, you eat catering, and then sometimes we party. started a little bit at before wrestling, but very rarely. And then it was, then we, after the Nitro, we were done with our business. We would take some somas and relax, a few beers, eat some dinner and have fun a little bit. And that was the schedule for 5 solid years of that, you know, with WCW, 5 years, every single night on the road, regimented that kind of a day. And the somas just creeped in a little sooner each time. But before they creeped in, we got in the car to go somewhere. It was me, Liz, and Lex. And we got in the car. And I remember got in the car. I got in. Lex was always a lot more hot than I was. And I'm a very hot-blooded guy, but Lex was like Mr. Freeze, brother. And so I got in the car and I was hot. I was sweating. And I was like, God dang, I'm kind of, you know, fidgety and, you know, trying to adjust the vents and everything. It was always Lex, me, and then Miss Liz. And I'm trying to adjust everything and stuff and just uncomfortable. And just as calm as Lex could say it, he goes, if you take a couple of pills and drink a beer, that'll go away. And I went, what? He goes, if you take a couple of pills and drink a beer, that'll go away. Now, keep in mind, drinking a beer at lunchtime and taking a pill was a loser. You're trash. And I said, so embarrassingly, I open up one beer and I take a couple of pills and I drink it and that feeling goes away. And I realized that day that I'd crossed what they call in rehab, the invisible line. Now I'm taking it because I need it, not because I want to. And it became an addiction that day for another, you know, 20 plus years.
Now, my cousin's been sober, I want to say 14, 15 years.
Wow.
And this is from her, coming from her, I want to see your thoughts on it. She says that, just like anything in life, one of the first things you have to do is you have to admit you have a problem. And then once you admit that, you start to mentally, I don't know, feeling better, but you start to understand things once you omit, she said, because she experienced the toughest thing that she had to face, besides kicking her addiction habits, was admitting that she had a problem. How hard was it for you to admit that?
That wasn't a problem. The problem was I just kept having things happen that didn't make sense. Like, you know, like I'd go to get a sleep study done. So here I am swallowing pills, drinking alcohol because I don't sleep good. And out of that comes, I get this thing called atrial fibrillation, which means your heart don't beat even. So go to the doctor, I get diagnosed with that, go to another doctor. Then I go to a sleep study because my wife is waking up crying, saying you're choking in your sleep. So I go to the doctor, do the sleep study, and the place says, you're totally normal. You're just a chronic snorer. And my wife's like, no, he's dying in his sleep. No, nothing wrong with him. So on that, on a doctor telling you there's nothing wrong with you, it was at least a whole nother year of addiction because I was told I was fine. So comes back again. We do another sleep study a year later and same thing. You're totally normal. So finally, I put my foot down. I go, look, guys, I've been suffering. My wife has been crying for 2 years now. There's more to this or something you're missing or something. And they go, well, they're trying to figure it out. They go, well, how do you go to bed at home? And I go, sedated. And they go, come to bed down here like that. And I said, okay. So I
took, No problem.
So I was trying to do the right thing by going to a medical procedure sober. But what needed to happen was I needed to do it like I do it at home. So very smart of them. So I do it. Somas, Xanax, drink, eating a pizza. I walk into my sleep study. 5 minutes into the sleep, they come in and put a mask on me. You've got severe sleep apnea. Now, as soon as I heard that word and they told me what it did and what it does, I was taking cocaine to play football when I was 17 years old because of sleep apnea, brother, but it was no diagnosis of it. You don't know at the time what you're doing. I was trying to fix something that I was sick from, but I didn't know I was sick. And you don't know what you're fighting. It's like fighting a ghost, but we fought the best we knew how, which my father's best way he thought was to give me cocaine. And I did cocaine to play my sport and it worked. So at a young age, I learned to fix the problem. I would fix it. Mm. And so I did, you know, and from that point on, when I learned about sleep apnea and AFib, your heart is a muscle and somas are muscle relaxers. And when I take the somas, it relaxed my heart. Well, here we go. Now, We know why you are taking this soma, it's because of your heart. We know all the things, but now they've cardioverted you. Your heart's fine. And they put a CPAP on your face. You're good with the CPAP, but now you're swallowing 60 pills a day and you're a drug addict. That's not no machine to fix that. So here come the rehabs. And you start with rehab and you go. And I remember going to my first, I only went to two rehabs with my CPAP. The first one I went to didn't work. The second one I got sober. I went to rehab with all the sleep apnea stuff and all that. And that one, I stayed sober about a month and a half on that one. But the secret to this rehab was that got me sober was I did aftercare. Day 31 on the first rehab I did with my CPAP machine, day 31, I was back on the road wrestling. So this one, I really went there to get better this time. So I did 30 days rehab, and day 31, I was in an aftercare place. So I did your, what you're supposed to do. I did your 120 days, which is 30 rehab, 90 aftercare. Then I did 90 meetings in 90 days. And then I got a sponsor, DUI court started with Cobb County. So I've been in programs from August 27th, 2022, which is my sobriety birthday, till today doing a drug test at DUI court. So I've been in a program of recovery for 21 months.
Man, speaking of that, so I can relate to you on multiple accounts on that. I broke my neck. I want to say I was, I got to think back, 22 years old. It was 2 weeks after my grandmother died. And I went out drinking. I gave my buddy my keys, and I'm at a bar, and I was ready to fight my guy over my car keys. He said, whatever happens, it's on you. Threw the keys on the ground. I get them, go to another house, party hard, leave, go to make a right-hand turn to go home. I get T-boned. I get thrown from the driver's seat to the back passenger seat. They cut the car open. I had to wear a neck brace, I want to say, probably about 8 months straight.
Wow.
Seven days a week. And I got hit with a DUI, too. So I can relate on both accounts.
It hurts.
Yeah,
it sucks. So you broke your neck. You did it. Yeah. So that's crazy. I hate that.
I got hit, but it was my fault.
Yeah, exactly. It was your fault for being under the influence and everything. But still, that's crazy. What levels did you break it at? Do you remember?
The lower ones, because like if you like my shoulders, my shoulders are still uneven when I stand up straight from it.
Really, mine are too a little bit. Did you have to get it fixed or not?
Part of me thinks I should have. They just said, wear this plastic neck brace for, you know, such and such amount of time, seven and a half, you know, 8 months straight. I didn't have to have a halo or nothing, but.
Yeah, that's good. That's good. I had to wear the halo, but that's because they went in and fixed mine. They had to fix mine. Mine, you know, I was paralyzed for 8 minutes because my cervical disc hit my spinal cord. So the medical term that happened to me was when I broke my neck, it bruised. When it broke it, it hit my cord. And by hitting your cord, they call that a bruised spinal cord. When you bruise your spinal cord, it swells. And when the swelling starts, you're paralyzed. And when the swelling goes back down, you can move again. But you don't know that. You're in the ring and it's over. I'm paralyzed. 3 hours later, when they untaped me, I was like, what? And they're like, yeah, you bruised your spinal cord. I'm like, thank you, God. I mean, who have you ever talked to or even know that is 100% paralyzed and then they're 100% okay? I've never seen it or ever heard it, but it happened to me.
Yeah.
When they wheeled me out in front of Lex and Sting, I played dumb. I was going, and I went, and they went, my God, what happened? I go, bro, I don't know. Ask the doctor. I'm just so, they were going to fly me home on a jet, but Lex and Sting drove me straight to the hospital. They put me straight in the hospital room like a hotel because they couldn't operate for 3 days and they didn't want me to get in trouble. Like they didn't want me to go to the gym, or if somebody would have came up behind me and just shoved me hard, if my neck would have gone like that, like it did the first time again, they could have went ahead and severed my spine, of course. So that thing that hit my cord was still there. So they had to go in and remove it out and put my hip back in place. And then plates and screws through here.
Yeah, I see it.
So medically, I'm fused at 3, 4, and 6, 7. Crazy.
That's nuts.
I know. They go through here, and they cut you here. They move your windpipe over, and they bolt 2 plates and 4 screws, I mean 8 screws, right here, and they put your windpipe back in place. And they told me after it, and it still affects me to this day. They told me after it, I would be weird eating for a while. So when I ate, food felt like it went. And when
That's
I
weird.
really weird. And when I had to burp, I would have to turn my head like to straighten my esophagus so I could belch. It was weird, brother. It was weird.
So I want to get back into into wrestling a little bit before we end this great conversation that we've had. When and where were you at when you realized that WCW wasn't going to be no more? I mean, obviously you knew, but like tall tale signs for you.
There
When
were
did you first realize?
There were no telltale signs. It was like the atomic bomb. It was just,
oh, wow.
It was boom. We were told in Jacksonville, Florida, the night before, when me and Lex lost the tag match with Palumbo and O'Hara, we bitched about it. We were mad about it. But Johnny Ace came to me and he goes, Bagwell, don't worry about it. We're taking a 6-week break. They were telling people that we were going to be on a 6-week break and that we're going to come back after a 6-week break. How they kept Vince McMahon buying WCW a secret, I have got no idea, brother, because they kept it from Lugers and Stings because I was their boy and it didn't get to us. We were in Panama City and me and Lex, and just ironically, Nash, Goldberg, and a few other guys, we got out of a car at the same time in Panama City. Everybody was talking, cutting up, and I was the first one to see it. I saw semis, WWF semis, and I went, and it didn't hit me. I go, hey guys, I go, what is WWF trucks doing here? And if I could take and show you Lex Luger's face, it said it all, but I didn't know. As soon as I saw his face, it wasn't good. But nobody said another word. Everybody just shut up. And you can see the top guys like Goldberg, Nash, Sting, and Lex went different directions. I followed Lex because me and Lex were totally buff. We had the tag team going totally buff. And I love Lex. So I followed Lex. And he went and saw Janie Engel. And I remember the visuals I had was people taking pictures with Ric Flair and crying. Office staff people taking pictures with Ric Flair and crying. Worried looks on everybody's faces. And before, and as I kind of was trying to process everything, one of their Indian promoters, can't remember his name, he goes, Shane McMahon's got a meeting in this room in 2 minutes. So 2 minutes, we're in the room. Everybody that worked for WCW was in this kind of small area and jam-packed in there. Shane walks in and goes, we bought the company. We own WCW. He goes, there's going to be some wrestlers we hire. And there's going to be some wrestlers we fire. There's going to be some referees we hire and some referees we fire. There's going to be some office staff. Same thing. He goes, good luck. And about half the crowd clapped. And Lex was not one of them. So I didn't either. And so about half the boys were like, you know, another half was like, I mean, it was a minute long, brother. It was a minute long of us trying to process. It's freaking over, you know, but trying to process it. Well, depressed as hell, I go to the car, I get my pills, and I throw them in my mouth, and I'm washing it down with my beer, and I see Luger running at me, and Luger didn't run ever. And I went, that's not good. So he goes, don't, he's saying, don't. I go, what? So roll the window down. He goes, don't take anything yet. And I go, I just did. He goes, well, come on before it hits you. And he goes, come on. I go, what? He goes, we got a pre-tape. So I don't know if this ever showed, but I can tell you, me and Lex Luger did a pre-tape for the first show in Panama City, Florida. Me and Lex did a pre-tape, and then I went home. But I don't know exactly if it ever showed or not. We do the pre-tape. I get in my car. We go home. On the way home, my phone rings, and it's my father. And he goes, are you watching the show? And I said, no, I'm driving home. He goes, well, he goes, Vince McMahon just said your name. And I said, what? He goes, yeah. He goes, he said it was five names. He goes, and you're one of the five. He goes, I know I'm your father. He said, but I think you got the second biggest reaction. And I said, that's got to be pretty good news. Well, by the time I talked to my people, like Lex and Sting, my clique, it was unbelievable news. Like Vince didn't do that. He didn't ever like say your name unless you were figured in. So I didn't take that like, yeah, I got a job. I took it as good news. So then they made me go to school and to learn a 20-foot ring. It's crazy. But I did, and that's where me and Helms got in the fight. And then, you know, then they it was just I thought there was going to be good news with him saying my name. So, you know, out of it came, you know, him buying our company and, you know, just kind of doing away with WCW. But I really thought it'd be a good thing when he said my name, but it ended up being not so good.
Now, you said it's where you and Helms got in a fight. Y'all actually got in a fist fight?
Well, the dark side of this ring is when I talk about that. I mean, I've told the story 10,000
times. No, you're right. You're right. You did. Yeah, you're right. You're right.
Yeah,
you're right.
Yeah, but we just had some words after a training session, and I slapped him, and he hit me with a water bottle, a frozen water bottle. He gave me 20 staples, 20 staples. I wrestled Booker T with 20 staples in my head.
Shit.
Yeah.
Jesus.
Yeah.
Man, I got a couple more questions. I don't want to keep you too much longer, as I know you're busy.
You're good. I love this.
Looking back at what you've went through personally, would you change anything?
That's a great question, brother. You know, I was thinking the other day about what I'm at with my recovery and being sober. And, you know, there's no way to know that I've done this recovery thing good or right unless you did the drunken addiction really bad and really hard. Yeah. So, and then you got to learn, then you got to be lucky enough to live through it, to tell it. Mm. So, and that's pretty deep when you wrap your head around all that. That's pretty deep, but it's the truth. Like, you can't be a great heel unless you're a great baby face first and vice versa. So you got to know all of one side to make a good other side. So like right now, if I hadn't partied and done crazy wild things on drugs, then how would I know my recovery's right? You wouldn't, because you didn't. You'd be asking yourself stuff like, well, I mean, maybe I got a couple more parties left in me. That's the kind of stuff you do through recovery anyway. But I pretty quick sum those thoughts up with, you've been there and you've done that, bro. And you almost died several times. So I just think at this stage, I have been lucky to live to tell the story.
Now, when you do tell your story to folks, does that help you in your recovery? Because recovery is an everyday thing, as my cousin would say. Does that help you?
I think so. I totally think so. I believe that. Well, I tell you this. When I got into recovery, 100%, I was going to show people what I did and have people follow what I did, because I was going to be a leader in recovery. This is the way Marcus Buck Bagwell got sober. This is the way that you should do it to get sober. And I found out real quick that was false. Recovery is a thing that you have got to find somebody that has been successful and you got to follow them. And that's exactly what I did. I followed the absolute handbook of getting sober, which is rehab, 90-day aftercare, 90 meetings in 90 days, get a sponsor, and work the steps. Those five things, you'll never hear anybody in their life do those five things and say, you know what, man, my life sucks. It wouldn't happen. It just doesn't. If you do those five things properly, you will succeed, you will be sober, and you will, I promise you, you will be happier.
What's your thoughts on the landscape of professional wrestling today and how it changes? Because now, you know, you got AEW, you got a lot of other stuff. Like, what's your thoughts in WWE? What's your thoughts on wrestling today?
It's not even in the same category as it was in that 95, 2001 area. It's not even the same galaxy, bro.
It's not.
Nobody looks the part anymore, man. It's like when The Rock came back, you know, and got in the ring, it just showed how the other guys didn't look good. They didn't look the part. The Rock looks like the WWE World Heavyweight Champion.
Yep.
Stone Cold looked like it. Lex Luger looked like it. Sting looked like it. Marcus Bagwell looked like it. Dallas Page looked like it. Scott Steiner looked like it. Kevin Nash looked like it. These guys don't look like it. I'm not being ugly. They just don't. And it makes a difference, man. I mean, there's guys that weigh 150 pounds and they say it. And I just don't understand, man. I don't understand. And so it's just much different. When I see a guy on the rope and he's jumping off at 180 pounds into five guys that are waiting on him to jump, my skin crawls. I mean, that guy would be fired as soon as he got back to the back during Nitro. My true heart feeling is 80% of the people on TV, 80% of them wouldn't be on the Nitro roster. They just wouldn't be on it. I mean, it's just, the card was pretty hard to make, brother. These guys just, I mean, I love Drew McIntyre. I love Seth Rollins. I love Cody Rhodes. But when The Rock got in the ring, it reminded me, Drew looks the part. There's not many Drews. There's not many Drews, brother. There's just not.
Right.
I just don't get it. We took pride in looking the best we could look, you know, to be the best champion we could be. And, you know, and a lot of guys did, but it just seems like there's not a lot of body guys in the world. But I still love the idea. I love AEWs like WCW. And the WWE is like the WWF. They're going to battle, like with ratings. And AEW is not as good as a company. Their ratings are worthless, but they're the WCW trying that just may have one of those 83 weeks in them, you know, and where they come out and beat them for 83 weeks. But it's just really, it's still exciting to me to watch. I love the business. I just wish I wanted, when I got released from the WWF, I wanted to turn the television on and go, oh my God, now I see why I got released, because that guy is there. And I have yet to say that after 24 years of being out of the business, yet to say, now I see why I got released.
Right.
I have never said it. I mean, to this day, I feel like I fit somewhere in there. I feel like I could be a good manager and could talk and do something with the top hat and the action and the charisma. I feel like, and I would love to be part of it somewhere. God, I'd love it. But it's just, I don't think it's in the cards, you know? I just don't think so. I hope it is one day and I'd give anything, but I just, right now it's not in the cards.
All right. Everything that you've been through in your life, is there ever been one person that you felt like you should have said sorry to that you never have or did?
I'm a real good sorry person. Let me think about that for a minute. I'm real good about, you know, clearing the air, man. I don't like carrying that, you know, that conviction,
that burden, bro.
And so, you know, the only time I can even kind of relate to what you're talking about is my mouth. And I don't even know what I said, but my mouth that got me in trouble with like five guys. It was Booker at WCW, Booker, Goldberg. And I can't remember the other three, but it was four or five guys that Lex came to me and goes, you got to go get this straight. And I remember talking to Goldberg. And I remember talking to Booker. I can't remember the other three, though, but I had to go make five amends with guys. And that was the only time I kind of had done that, where, and I didn't know what I had done, but I remember I had to go kind of get it back, let them see Mark Bagwell and say sorry, you know? So I had no problem saying I'm wrong and I'm sorry my whole life. I never had that chance at the WWF. They never gave me a chance to say sorry or wait a second, or, I mean, it was never told to me, the rumor I heard, which was bad match and my mother called. I'm not quite sure how that works, but
right.
the people actually believed it. But it was never told to me, you're fired. Never told me. It was told to me when they were going to release me for 3 months and then bring me back. Now, I knew it meant fired, but it's not what they said. So I was hoping they wasn't firing me. And I raised my hand to ask what the difference was. And they told me that they were going to have to redo my contract at firing me. And if I just release me, I can come back in 3 months. And again, I knew that was bad, but I still was kind of like Jim Carrey. So you're saying I've got a chance, you know?
Yeah.
So, but that's kind of where it was. And when I called back, Jim Ross, and it was over. But it just, you know, it just, the sorry thing was very easy for me to do. I didn't have the chance to say sorry.
Right. Marcus, before I ask our last question, I want to tell you thank you. Hopefully you've enjoyed yourself.
Yes.
When Marcus Bagwell's time on earth is said and done, how does Marcus want to be remembered?
I want to be remembered as a very honest, good, transparent, trustworthy, great human. I just want people, when they hear my name, to know that when I spoke, it was always the truth, because it is. And I really think if you watch that Dark Side, it's real hard to tell a story that's 40 years old and two men and two ex-wives tell the exact same story. That's hard to do, brother. And yep. To me, it is a reflection of one thing. It's a reflection of Mark Bagwell is a good human because that's what I am. I am a good human. And because of me being a good human, it would have showed in so many areas. When you got two women in two different cities talking, you got a man, a father, in a different house than I am, a different city, and you put all those voices and all those heads on the same show, you could eat that alive if it was a lie.
Yep.
But it's not, and none of it was a lie. Exaggeration a little with Mark, but none of mine was exaggerated. I told the truth, and it is the truth. Mark just exaggerated a little bit with my dad coming in throwing eight balls. I mean, he gave us a little coat, but he didn't come in with eight balls. And my right. mom didn't hold my nuts, you know, but see, I mean, it was right there. It was a little bit of extra jam on it, but you know, very transparent, very honest. Just, you know where you're at with me the first 10 seconds we talk, and I find value in that.
I'm the same way. Marcus, thank you, sir. Again, hopefully
thank you,
you
brother.
Enjoyed yourself.
I loved it.
And I'll be chatting with you again soon, man.
Stay in touch with me.
Yes, sir.
Thanks, Corey. Bye-bye.
See you, man.
The bad boys are wrestling, testing competition, win the war, that's their mission. Not no mercy, see the race like the street. If you